Imagine it's the year 2040 and you just bought the newest smartphone. You open the box and read over the product information. Assembled in China, features supercapacitor batteries, made with genuine asteroid-sourced tungsten. The idea of finding rare metals mined in space in your smartphone might sound like the stuff of science fiction, but with private companies entering and upending the space race, this could become a reality sooner than you think. Welcome to the era of new space.
Old space is the fantastic, you know, NASA Apollo program that took astronauts to the moon. Absolutely amazing technology, but all expendable, all just throwaway systems.
New space, it's a mixture of the venture capital perspective, the Silicon Valley perspective, the idea that you want to preserve for the sake of science and discovery, the surfaces of different planets. At the same time, there is probably money to be made, and maybe some things like asteroids, comets, as much science as we could learn from them, they are also interesting targets for commercial activity. Mining platinum group metals or doing other things of potential value in space.
The private sector is coming for the cosmos. But before we can all reap the benefits of space, private industry innovators must overcome one big problem: the prohibitively high cost of getting to and from space. Welcome to The Future According to Now, a branded podcast from Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic and Fidelity Investments. Technology holds so much potential. Some of it sounds really far-fetched, but some of it matters right now. This podcast explores groundbreaking innovations that hold real potential to change our lives in the foreseeable future, but not always in the ways you might imagine. In this episode, we'll hear about reusable spacecraft, scramjets, and hypersonics, technologies that might just bring the final frontier within reach for the private sector, and a Fidelity investment expert who delves deeper into the potential opportunities to invest in space. I'm your host, Vicky Virgolino. Whether or not you grew up dreaming of becoming an astronaut or an astrophysicist, you probably thought of NASA as the central force behind space exploration. But as it turns out, NASA has long been more of a guiding light than a primary driver of space innovation.
You know, NASA virtually never builds spacecraft. And they do have technology developments, but they're few and far between, certainly compared to industry and academia.
That's Dr. Mason Peck. Today, he heads the Space Systems Design Studio at Cornell, but was previously the chief technologist at NASA from 2011 to 2013, giving him a deep understanding of the balance between the private and public sectors in space exploration.
NASA folks and sometimes the public, you know, we get a little confused. They think that NASA is where the discoveries are made and the spacecraft are built. That's not really true. You know, for the most part, the science is done by principal investigators at universities. The technologies are developed at companies and, again, at universities. You know, 80% of NASA's budget goes outside the walls, outside of the 10 NASA centers. It goes to small businesses, large businesses, universities. That's where the work is done. And this relationship has always worked really well in the past.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground.
Though this balance has functioned well for many years, today the dynamic is shifting dramatically. Rapid technological advancements are lowering the barrier to entering the space race. This means that small companies and young startups are not just holding their own, but actually pioneering some of the most exciting space tech that's out there.
Companies like Boeing, Lockheed, United Launch and Alliance, these are kind of the traditional spacecraft or rocket companies. They continue to be an important part of how space is done, but we see a lot more successful risk-taking in these younger companies.
Staying up to date on the latest players in the space race can feel like a full-time job. For Jonathan Sigman, an equity research analyst for defense and commercial aerospace at Fidelity, it is. He's keeping a close eye on the most innovative players in the field of space exploration and research, and he's seeing market activity in the private sector.
Watching for disruptive technologies that could change economics of various business plans and opportunities to grow. Recently, there's been a surge of private investments in space startups, $13 billion since 2000. Names that people know are causing quite a bit of disruption by offering significantly cheaper launch services, for example, 40% cheaper than incumbent services.
What sorts of opportunities does the private sector see in the great void anyway?
So one of the promises of affordable space access is the ability to mine asteroids for rare minerals. So that could be a game changer in availability of some of these rare minerals if you solve the cost problem of transport to and from Earth.
This idea of an intergalactic gold rush has governments and industry paying attention. Mining for palladium and platinum and other precious metals could prove quite rewarding. Palladium is used in countless machine parts, electronics, batteries, and it's even used in groundwater treatment. And this wouldn't be the first time that technologies created for the cosmos have big payoffs back here on Earth.
There's been a long history of space advances developing many new materials that benefit everyday people for the last 5 decades.
All of us just don't know enough about a major aspect of our space program. I refer to the hundreds of human-oriented technological spin-offs from the program.
You know, everything from advances in radio tires to the cushionings and beds and pillows to firefighting equipment. Most traditional aircraft materials can't handle the heat, and so there's going to be new alloys, new composites, ceramics used in these applications.
It turns out some of the materials created for exploring space have gone on to be used in diapers, memory foam, and might even be helping your golf swing.
I'd highlight carbon fiber as a material that was developed initially for space applications. The heat and light weight was used in the reinforced with graphite used in the nose cone of the space shuttle. Now has been widely adopted in commercial aircraft. 50% of the mass of a new commercial aircraft is composites relative to nothing decades ago. Composite advances has now moved to things such as autos and golf clubs and wind turbines. So it's migration of material advances from the space program will find its way to other applications.
So how do we usher in a reality that takes full advantage of asteroid mined minerals and affordable commercial space flights? Well, that brings us back to the cost problem that Jonathan mentioned. In the old space era, when space exploration was just science for the sake of science, and just getting there was enough, the price tag of missions was of little concern. But today, for companies with a bottom line to watch, that model isn't cutting it anymore.
The main impediment to the space industry right now, and from a commercial and business point of view, you know, supplying services from satellites, but also, you know, going off and exploring, is the massive cost of going to space.
That's Dr. Michael Smart, a professor of hypersonic propulsion at the University of Queensland in Australia.
The cost of launch is way, way more than the cost of the actual craft that you take up there, or your satellites that you take up there. And the reason it costs so much is because you throw it away every time. And you can just imagine how much that costs. Like, imagine if every time we flew across the Pacific Ocean, you know, the 747 got thrown away. And so this idea of reusability can really reduce the cost of going to space.
Reusable spacecraft will allow the private sector to cut costs and set up shop in the cosmos. And from his unique position straddling the public and private sides of space research, Dr. Mason Peck at Cornell has seen some exciting developments in reusability from private companies.
Yeah, reusability is a big deal for SpaceX. It's a big deal for all of us in a number of ways. One of my favorite ideas from Elon Musk is he's going to charge more for used rockets, which seems to go exactly against your instinct, right? You're thinking, it's used. Oh, no, it's nearer to failure, right? But no, his point is, if it's been used, it's been proven. So that's just an example of how the economics of space change when you have reusability and when you've got enough of a market to justify reusability.
NASA is now partnering with private companies to deliver payloads to space, which has in turn sped up the interest and development of reusable technology to get there. In 2014, under President Obama, they contracted out to Boeing and SpaceX for the first time to transport crew and supplies to the International Space Station. Now, SpaceX has developed the ability to reuse its rockets, as they proved for the first time last December with a mission CRS-13, its first reusable rocket actually used in a NASA mission. Like a commercial airliner, it sees value in a rocket booster that's, quote, flight proven. Reusable spacecraft may be the key to getting us to and from space without breaking the bank. But building them is no small feat. Luckily, Professor Smart and his team are on the case, working with one technology that might hold the answer.
Scramjet, it stands for a supersonic combustion ramjet. And they're an air-breathing engine. They're more like a jet engine than they are like a rocket in the way they operate. And so if you're flying like a plane, once a plane has, you know, done its job, in the case of going to space, accelerating and launching a satellite off its back, it can just fly back to base and just land on a conventional runway. And that's why scramjets enable this reusability to be applied to space. It just brings this whole idea of aircraft-like operations to hypersonic speed and therefore also to space.
If these experts can figure out how to control the heat created when scramjets fly at hypersonic speeds, then they could become a reusable mode of transport to and from space. Taking a step back, what exactly is hypersonic technology? In a word, it is speed. Mach 1 is the speed of sound. A typical commercial airline flight travels below Mach 1, around Mach 0.85. When you get to supersonic speeds, this goes faster than the speed of sound. Maybe Mach 2, Mach 3, all the way up to Mach 5. But hypersonic?
Mach 5 is where hypersonics begin. So anything faster than Mach 5 is considered hypersonic, all the way up to Mach infinity, I suppose.
To fly at hypersonic speeds in space is just fine. But when a spacecraft is pushing up against Earth's atmosphere at Mach 5, it makes things incredibly hot. This remains one of the biggest challenges to hypersonic flight. And Jonathan Sigmund at Fidelity says we've been working on this for a while now.
Hypersonics has been an area of focus really since the end of World War II. So the very first hypersonic aircraft officially was in 1949, the German V-2.
In one of these buildings, the once dreaded German V-2 rocket is assembled and prepared for launching by ordnance men. No longer a weapon of war, the V-2 is doing an important post-war job in cosmic research.
The fact that we've been at this for, you know, decades, I think demonstrates the inherent technical challenges in perfecting it.
If traveling at hypersonic speeds has stumped experts for nearly 70 years, how likely is it that it will become a reality anytime soon, enabling reusable scramjets to tote us to and from space like airliners?
Right now, most of the advances in hypersonics that are closer to reality are on the military side. As the country pivots to prioritizing investments to counter peer adversaries, hypersonics is one area that's been identified as a game-changing technology that we need to actually catch up to advances made by China and Russia.
Hypersonic missiles could reach targets anywhere on the planet in less than an hour. Even our advanced current intercontinental ballistic missile systems take longer and are less maneuverable. So the U.S. is not resting on its laurels. Both the government and private industry have made advances in creating and testing hypersonic missiles, to include the AHW and Lockheed Martin's HTV-2.
So defense spending has shown long cycles through time. The focus will be on the recapitalization of strategic equipment and assets. Part of that focus is on munitions and advanced missiles, and hypersonics is a very important part of that, highlighted by congressional leaders and Secretary Mattis. I'd highlight the $400 million they're receiving in fiscal 19, which is a 160% increase on some of the various public programs, which I believe is just the tip of the iceberg of what's being spent when you consider classified hypersonic areas.
Though somewhat under the radar of the public due to the nature of missile defense, I asked Jonathan if people should still keep an eye on hypersonic technology.
It most definitely should be watched, because the powers in the Pentagon and in Congress and the people that have access to the real classified truth are really concerned about this and want more investments in this area. So just because most of the companies that are public can't talk about what they're doing here, it's my view we should have a whole lot of confidence that this is a growing area.
Though these and countless other technologies are still in the works, these experts are optimistic that commercial travel to and from space is within reach for us all, and they believe the time is now.
If you look back at what futurists have been saying for decades, every generation or so we say, this is the space generation. This is the generation where space will become like personal computers. And I hate to be one of those guys, but I'm going to say that. I'm going to say that this is the decade where we will turn the corner or crest the peak.
The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time.
Next time, shopping habits are changing. Can brick and mortar adapt to survive?
People have a hard time visualizing what the end result is going to look like. Our hypothesis was that an immersive virtual experience could actually make a person feel like they had done the experience, which would transfer, you know, greater knowledge than YouTube video or reading about doing something. Our results so far, you know, show that that's actually the case.
On the next episode, The Showroom Without the Shopping. The Future According to Now is a podcast from Fidelity Investments. To learn more or to get in touch, visit us at theatlantic.com/fidelitypodcast. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Promotional content produced by Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic for Fidelity Investments, parentheses Fidelity. Fidelity and Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic, are independent entities. The views and opinions expressed by the speakers are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of Fidelity or its affiliates. Information presented is for information purposes only and is not investment advice or an offer of any particular security. This information must not be relied upon in making any investment decision. Fidelity cannot be held responsible for any type of loss incurred by applying any of the information presented. These views must not be relied upon as an indication of trading intent of any Fidelity fund or Fidelity advisor. Fidelity and the Fidelity Investments and Pyramid Design logo are registered service marks of FMR LLC, copyright 2018. FMR LLC, all rights reserved. Fidelity products and services are offered by Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE, SIPC, 900 Salem Street, Smithfield, Rhode Island, 02917, 845-824.1.0.